Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
That's an interesting accent. It's definitely not what I was expecting.
I'm not even aware that I have an accent. I'm in the middle of the United States, so that's probably part of it.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like Bill Clinton's accent.
He sounds a little more southern than I do, I think. But
right.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, I enjoy your voice, and that certainly is a new element, obviously, on your forum. I haven't enjoyed your voice, your writer's voice particularly, mm-hmm. Whereas I do enjoy your speaking voice. And I don't think you can overestimate just the enjoyment of somebody's voice, the possibility of enjoying somebody's voice.
That's why I consciously made that decision to drop out of I kept up with your forums, but it just became totally inactive, except for Paige White and his thing.
Yeah.
But I dropped out of there because I sensed that. It's like, you know, I'm not here to try to piss anybody off or anything. And no matter what I say now, I felt like it was just going to be taken that way. So I just needed to back away for a while. And like I said, I listened to your podcast. I read your blog articles and everything. And I thought, I continue to get enjoyment out of reading these things. So what's the problem? And that's when I started questioning it. What is my problem, you know? What is my problem with what you're posting on your forums or whatever? And I really don't know the problem, other than maybe the way something is presented and maybe thinking that other people are going to read it and make up their minds about something. And it's like, okay, well, there's more to it than this one little quote here. And
I think it is?
It has nothing to do really with your investigations and sharing it with people, and maybe it makes them investigate it further. But maybe I put that past people. Maybe I don't think people are going to do that.
Well, we didn't get to this, and we're winding up now anyway, but...
Yeah, we really do need to wind up.
But still, it is a... Obviously, it's a central question of why we're talking in the first place. So, do you want to know what I think it is, based on having talked to you today?
That would be great. I'd love to hear it.
I think that you are a frustrated writer yourself.
I don't know about that so much, because I don't really write a lot.
I could extrapolate from that, but I'm not sure I want to, but I'll just extrapolate a very little bit, that if you see or hear or read me propagating certain ideas, and you want to intercede to correct in some way, but you're not sure why, because generally you agree with me, that suggests that in some way that my voice challenges your voice, or your sense of having a voice, and so that suggests to me that... And you did say about Lucifer more than once that when you read it, it was the kind of book that you could have written.
Mm-hmm.
So that also suggests that some part of you wanted to have written it. Or have written made your own testimony.
I must say, I always feel like there's something one of these days when I get my thoughts together in a certain way that I will write it down. But you're probably right. I'm probably frustrated at not being able to communicate my ideas, or I should say, I'm not satisfied with anything I've written. There's a lot of people that say that, hey, you should write a book or something, but I always feel like, as soon as it's said, as soon as I've posted something online, I'm taking a lot of time to really put it together in a certain way. It's almost like there's a sense of regret. Like, I just put this out there, now it's concrete. Mm-hmm. And I don't like things to be that concrete. And it's like when it's in writing, other people make it concrete by reading it and thinking this is the way he thinks all the time.
That's
20
that
years
thing
from
again.
now, you know, it's
Yeah, that's that thing with Lucid View. Because I have some regret about writing Lucid View, and it's partly that, and it's what you said about how there might have been some rivalry there because of you projected onto the rider, the invisible rider of Lucid View, your own things.
Yeah, you're probably right about that to a certain extent. I'd have to give it some more thought, but I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it's like mirrors. It's like there's a mirroring thing, like that experiment you talked about with the mirrors. It's like you and I, well, that experience of you reading Lucid View, because I wasn't really present, but then later when we interacted, like there was a kind of setting up of these two mirrors with the Lucid View in between them.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I didn't really have time to go over your Crowley article here too much. I read it yesterday real quick, and there's a couple of things about it.
Mm-hmm.
Your overall, the case that you're trying to make, I don't necessarily disagree with it. You know, I think you make a good case. However, some of the sources that you're drawing from are kind of questionable, which is what,
mm-hmm.
that's usually what I have a problem with, you know. In your new and old commentaries, I am familiar with those. And like I said, it's kind of, when you quote something like this to the average reader, in my opinion, when they read it, you know, the kind of laziness involved in not checking these things and not reading the full context that it's coming out of, it can make it seem like exactly what the case it is that you're making, you know, that's, if you go to those commentaries and kind of read what that's coming from, I don't get the impression personally that he's advocating just having sex with children or anything. I mean, mainly because of the one thing that he adds in that. Let's see, the B666 ordains by his authority that every man and every woman and every immediately sexed individual shall be absolutely free to interpret and communicate self by means of any sexual practices whatsoever. Whether direct or indirect, rational or symbolic, physiologically, legally, ethically, or religiously approved or no, provided only that all parties in any act are fully aware of all implications and responsibilities thereof and heartily agree thereto. Yeah, I get that. That is in your quote. I didn't see it there. That last line there, I think, is actually important. I mean, I wouldn't think a newborn baby could agree to anything. So I don't think he's advocating anything like that.
Well, that's a sliding scale, isn't it? That's a moving line, and that's one of the things that I tried to point out with the pedophile information exchange and the whole idea of abolishing the age of consent. And part of that was backed up by the claims that you can tell whether a child is agreeing or not by subtle cues. It doesn't have to be verbal, right?
Yeah, like I said, I don't disagree with what you're trying to get across here. I just think pointing at Aleister Crowley as a source to back it up, I'm not sure that's really the best thing. It almost strikes me more as like what a Christian fundamentalist would be doing. But I think there's better cases to be made with better sources, is what I'm trying to
say.
Like,
you mean, but the piece is about Crowley. I mean, it's not.
Yeah, I know. That's, but I mean.
So it has more to do with, I mean, of course, there's a larger context of me exploring the possibility that various different influences Well, figures that we think of one way are actually part of this larger memeplex, let's say. And so using Crowley as another example, there is that, but I think more primary is my own personal I mean, he's important and significant to me because of the degree of influence that he's had on me, right? And so then I'm extending that interest, and I could even say that, well, you could definitely say that preoccupation, to others, as in how much we have been influenced by a figure that we may have insufficiently understood. So in that sense, it's primarily about Crowley and the influence that he's had, and only secondarily about the larger case that that there are these agendas and that there are these drives behind a lot of the philosophies that look more and more like rationalizations, I'd say, in this possibility. So, as you know, I got the larger concern or even conviction at this point, although I think we both agree that that's not necessarily a good thing to have, to be a convict to convictions, about occultism being, well, a trap or a dead end, and why, and the overlaps between occultism and the pursuit of power or empowerment and the abuse of children. This seems to be like a real overlap, historically speaking. And so that, looking at the evidence of the historical overlap as a way to better understand the possible overlap, philosophically speaking, I suppose, would be one way of trying to sum up what that piece is an example of me trying to do.
Necessarily disagree with you either. I've always thought occultism was a trap. My own background, I don't have any religious upbringing that ever colored my how I approach things, I guess. But for a lot of people, to me, occultism is like a replacement for what they're trying to rebel against. And they're like you always talk about the second matrix, they're just replacing one prison with another. And that's something I've always kind of subtly pushed when I'm talking to others, and I am engaged in kind of the occult community, at least online. So when I'm talking about it, I always try to slip these things in there that unless you're actually trying to really free yourself of these things, you're really not engaging in any real magical practice. I mean, that's why I'm attracted to what you do so much, because you actually seem to, when I first read The Lucid View, I knew that you understood these things. And I knew that, in a way, the lucid view seemed like a purging of those things to me, which is what it was for me at the time as well, to a certain extent. When I read it, it's like, this is everything I've been into for the past, I don't know, at that time, it was probably about 15 years or so. And it's like, here's somebody that understands how I understand it. And that's why I've kind of, I haven't really followed you strictly, you know, since then, but occasionally I'd come across you again and what you're doing lately and things like that. It's like, oh yeah, you're still on that same journey of kind of purging all of this out of you in some way. And that's kind of where I've been. I've just not been as aggressive about it as maybe you have. But, I mean, you don't sound like an aggressive person, but as far as trying to get to the root of these things, you kind of are.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that. It's an interesting question about lucid view then, because, I mean, one of the reasons it's written the way that it was written, which is in this questioning tone and sort of all within the context of paranoid awareness. So I have a lot of sentences like paranoid awareness says, or the paranoid believes, etc., etc. Was, I mean, yes, I was aware of course, because I even quote, like, I mean, that's an occult doctrine in itself, is you don't believe, you just act as if you believe and see what the results are, and that's quoted in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that, but then there's a sort of weird conundrum in that, because if you have to believe in that as a magical doctrine, you know, that's not an as if, right? To practice that, you are actually. But anyway, leaving that aside for a moment, the other reason was that I wanted more credibility. I wanted the reader to be more open to some of those models. And I knew that that's the way to do it, rather than saying this is the way they are, saying that. And I learned this writing The Blood Poets, which was the, although I'd written The Lucid View, what it was originally was The Message, two words. Before I wrote The Blood Poets, I hadn't published it, and when I wrote The Blood Poets about film, and I didn't know it was going to be an academic press, but I think I must have instinctively had some sense of the academic style and how it, in academic writing you can propose, you can talk about any number of ideas because you're speaking sociologically and you know that these are narratives that exist in our culture, so you don't have to believe in them, and you don't have to admit to believing in them, and you don't have to say whether you believe or not. It's irrelevant in the academic field. You're just presenting models and narratives to analyze them. So then I could write about certain films, and towards the end of Blood Poets I was writing about the X-Files and what have you, and so then I was able to put in my beliefs at that time in disguise in this way, and I put footnotes from Jim Keith's books about femur and black helicopters and you name it, you know, I was inserting it in there covertly under the guise of, well, isn't this all just interesting kind of observing the belief systems that are being carried by these forms of entertainment. And so then in Lucid View I kind of learnt that method, and so I was framing everything in that way, you know, this is what people believe, isn't it curious? But the truth was is that I did believe a lot of that stuff. And so when I went back to Lucid View recently, like more recently than the new edition that I made, whenever it was, I think it was 2013, so still fairly recently, I didn't get very far at all, because I felt like, God, I would just throw out so much at this point, like post-Prisoner Infinity. My approach has changed so much in terms of, it's no longer just about these are interesting beliefs and I secretly believe them, so I'm going to just put them out there in a form that seems kind of neutral, but basically my goal was to propagate these ideas as challenging ideas. Now I've seen more and more, I believe I've seen anyway, the ways in which these ideas and narratives have actually been created in order to be believed in, and so I feel as though I was actually I wasn't nearly as skeptical as I needed to be. I mean, just quoting people now, I would be very wary of, like, see what I mean by how much has changed since then.
Mm-hmm.
My outlook, and I mean, paradoxically or ironically, or perhaps even, I won't say tragically, but it's definitely a risk that I'm encountering, is that in a sense you could say I've become more dogmatic than then, because I feel like I have a better sense of what the ground is. And back then there was a kind of dilettante kind of enjoyment of what if this was true, and what if nothing we know is true, and kind of just pulling out the ground or the false ground. But I think I had this, I don't know, but maybe partly had this idea that is quite common in these circles, which is that there is no real ground, or that it's all relative anyway, and that reality is shaped by belief, or anyway, whatever the case, I certainly have much more of a sense of what I actually want to communicate now outside of other people's models, I guess.
That's interesting that I realize you saying that now, that I probably misread the Lucid View that first time back in 2005, because at that time, like I said, I projected my own playfulness into it. Like, you're playing with these ideas and throwing them out there in that way, but I didn't realize you were actually believing them. I read it in the sense of, like, Robert Anton Wilson, like the way he was writing Cosmic Trigger. Mm. It would say the skeptic saw it this way, and the true believer, and he was referring to basically himself, the different aspects of himself and how they would interpret the information coming in. Mm. And that was more my background, is when I read the Lucid View, I thought, okay, Aeolus Cephas, this is the next Robert Anton Wilson. That was kind of how I read it. You're picking up that torch and running with it.
Yeah, that was certainly a conscious goal on my part. So you went wrong entirely.
But the thing with Wilson, though, was this whole model agnosticism, which is something I've adhered to probably since I first read that book, maybe the second time I read it, which was about maybe 8 months after I first read it.
Wilson's book.
Yeah, Wilson's book. I first read that in 1994. And I didn't understand it. I got about maybe three quarters of the way through and I was done with it. Gave it back to the person that lent it to me. And then the same kind of things that he talked about in the book started happening to me kind of spontaneously. I had a sickness, an infection. I had a low-grade fever that remained with me for a couple of months straight. So you can imagine, I mean, you could say that's kind of a trauma that caused some of this paranormal type things to happen. And I said, oh, this is what Wilson was talking about. So I went back to that book later and I understood it a little differently, and ever since then I realized that you can kind of interpret experiences in so many different ways. It's best to throw belief out and allow the raw experience to be what it is kind of how I took it from there. So by the time Lucid View came into my hands, it was all of those things you were talking about is what I had been investigating myself, kind of trying to understand my own experiences. Of course you're going to enter into this whole world, and it's like, okay, by that time I had so bombarded myself with these things that Lucid View just seemed like how I would write it if I was to write about it. And I'm not a writer, so I never really got to that point, but I always thought that would be the book I would have written at that time. And then when your Homo Sapiens came out, which seemed kind of like a continuation of the similar ideas, I wasn't so much into that then. I understood it, I thought it was a good book, and it's like, yeah, all these ideas, I'm still interested in them, but it didn't really resonate with me as the same, because it's kind of moved from that. I still talk about a lot of these things online, but I can't say that I'm as interested in them as I used to be. But I'm still engaged with a lot of people that are, so I still adhere to it to a certain extent. But I try to slip in certain things about how you're just trapping yourself further by continuing down that line. Mm-hmm. That second matrix you're always referring to. I mean, I was aware of that early on as well. I think in Matrix Warrior, I read that right after Lucid View. I think I finished Lucid View and I stumbled across that book in the bookstore like within that same week. Of course, I put two and two together and I asked you about it then. Are you the same person? And you denied it, but I knew it. I mean, just the wording of certain things was like, this is too similar.
Mm-hmm.
But The Matrix
Warrior. Probably the only person in the world who had made that realization as quickly as that would be my guess.
Yeah, when you came out about it, which I wasn't keeping up with you at that time. It was not long after, you know, you came out about who you were on the, I guess it was your Stormy Weather podcast, which
yeah,
I
just after it ended. Yeah,
yeah, I didn't listen to any of that. I wasn't keeping up with what you were doing. I think it was a little bit after that. I'm not sure. And then I found your Stormy Weather forums and I joined there for a little while, and that's when I started kind of keeping up with what you were doing, but then I backed out again. I think after Homo Sapiens came out I kind of backed away from it, and then when you came back with the body culture, is that how you're pronouncing that? Then I started looking at it again, and then your Strieber piece really captivated me. It's like, oh yeah, okay, I can get with this, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you're not a practicing occultist, or you are? How would you put what category or what? Where on the spectrum would you place?
I'm probably more an ambiguous practitioner, I guess. I've done a lot of those things, you know, but lately I've kind of grown away from it. But I have done the scrying. I've channeled messages and things. I don't share a lot of this stuff online. I'm not the next Crowley trying to bring in the new age or anything. But I have been down that road, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, not so much. I'm more researching and investigating, studying, and that's more my mode anymore. Looking deeper into why I've been interested in these things, and it's a similar path as yourself, probably. Which is why I'm keeping up with a lot of what you do lately, especially the podcasts. I listen to them pretty regularly now.
So if you had to what would you say is the purpose of this conversation, let's say? Like what is it that's most of interest or of issue or to you right now talking to me, if anything?
I think it came about, you originally invited me to do a chat when we were having our issues on your forums.
Yeah.
And I kind of backed away from those forums, and then I went back to them not long ago, and I was reading over, you know, that, I don't even remember the name of the thread now, about that, the book that I recommended, which I will admit,
Outside of Heaven.
Yeah, it really wasn't that great of a book, but when I was reading over our discussion, I thought we really need to talk about this. It was kind of, that's kind of what brought it on. I'm not so sure we even need to talk about it at this point, because I've read over it several times since then, and I kind of cringe at it, and it's kind of like we could just move on from there. But I don't know. I just felt that maybe if we talk face to face, more or less, that it maybe we get a different impression of each other. Because I know when I listen to your podcasts, you don't strike me as that same person that was posting on the forums. It's something is lost in the text, I think.
Yeah.
So I think that maybe from my end, it's something like that too. Maybe what I was trying to convey was lost in just reading the text and projecting and not really getting, maybe I was joking about certain things or saying it in jest. Maybe I was just trying to make a point, devil's advocate kind of point.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really have an agenda, if that's what you're asking about.
Interesting
chat.
Not necessarily an agenda, but a sense of what it is that's brought us to this place, and you kind of laid out the mundane elements, if you will, the series of events that's led to the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I would say a couple of things. One being that the moving on notion, I'm all with that in theory, but in practice I find that moving on is usually a mistake because the thing that you want to move on isn't actually resolved, so it's more just a question of let's pretend it's not there. When people say move on, that tends to be what they mean, I think, or what they want. So there's that. Then specifically about the text thing, I think this is an interesting side topic in terms of what is lost in communication through text, because I think that there's, as with many things, there's a flip side to that. There's also something that is gained. So maybe it's not the best parallel, but in vino veritas, when two people are drunk, obviously they lose a lot in terms of clear communication, but there's also something that comes through that wouldn't come through otherwise, because they've lost control in that way. So this is also true in text, that we lose a certain degree of control on the one hand, while on the other we're perhaps being too controlled, because you could say it's more controlled to write a text message than it is to have a conversation. But on the other hand, I don't know how to finish that sentence, but just specifically, there is something I think that comes through in text precisely because of its limitations that might not come through otherwise. And so the ways in which we disagreed, and I would certainly agree that I'm different in text than I am otherwise, and more abrasive, always have been. I think I'm a lot less abrasive in all ways than I used to be, but I think it was particularly necessary, let's say, for me to adjust my way of communicating through text, because I did tend to be abrasive. And added to that, I think the way that I communicated with you, I mean, there's no doubt about it, I was aware of it. Like, just about every time you posted, I was triggered by it. And so that's an interesting thing, because that's like, well, okay, when people are triggering each other, you could say, well, they're not really communicating. But on the other hand, so yeah, let's just get away from that experience of triggering one another and try to communicate outside of our triggers. But on the other hand, triggering each other is a way of communicating, isn't it? Because you're actually seeing a side of yourself that you wouldn't see otherwise. So in that sense, I mean, that's kind of why I asked if you have a particular focus, or I said issue, it's a bit more of a loaded term, because to me, I'm coming to this conversation with more baggage than usual, perhaps, in that regard, because there is, like, for me, as you heard on the Jonathan Leatham conversation, because you mentioned it and how you came up in that conversation, you have come to represent something to me in my psyche, which I'm sure is very nuanced, so if I describe it, I will limit it and reduce it, but it has to do with, I suppose, in what I'm doing with Crowley, and why I said it's very important to me to look at Crowley's influence on me. It's kind of a mirror of that, like, what has my influence been on you, because you're somebody that I've been aware of for a very long time as somebody who is receiving my output and appreciating it, and amplifying the signal, even, because you were posting about it online, and who I subsequently had these very strong disagreements with. And so then there's a question of, you know, what is that, and how does that pertain in any way to how I've miscommunicated, how I've actually misrepresented myself, or questions that are obviously very vital to me when I'm looking at Streber and Crowley, like, or whoever, are these people deliberately misrepresenting, and are they deliberately misinforming, and etc. I could put it much more strongly, but I won't. And then the flip side of that, have I been, you know, how have I been affected by their output? So obviously that's always reflecting back on me. As you said, I'm, compared to you, I'm much more aggressive in my trying to tackle these issues. Well, the simplest way in which that aggression, one could rephrase aggression just in terms of being proactive, right? It's not necessarily aggressive, but it's certainly proactive, as in I'm doing it in public, and I'm even challenging public figures, and so yeah, aggressive isn't necessarily a bad word for it.
The way you discussed Jonathan, was it Lethem or Lethem?
Lethem. Yeah.
The way you were talking to him about our little disagreements, I don't know that I totally agreed with how, but I mean, I can't remember the details of what you said there. Trying to think of it.
I tell you what I remember, and it might spark something for you. I remember, because Leeson was talking about his own experience with fans, and I've avoided using that word until now because I think it's insulting to everyone concerned. But
yeah, I don't like the word fan either. But
no, but anyway, an avid reader or listener, what have you, somebody who's paying very close attention.
Mm-hmm.
There's a syndrome there, and I don't know if I mentioned Girard with Leeson, but it definitely comes up with René Girard, which is mimesis, which is when one person is drawn to another in some way because of an affinity. There's a tendency to imitate, and then the imitation leads to rivalry, and then of course the rivalry leads to violence. So that whole mechanism, if you will, I felt, I mean, from my end of the experience, was playing out with you, because I experienced you as somebody who was an avid supporter, who then became like a thorn in my side, so to speak. Mm. It was just constantly challenging, and I didn't really see it. The challenges felt like they were emotionally charged in a way that suggested some unconscious factor, let's say.
Yeah, I remember that now. What I was going to say about it, it's more... I guess I didn't realize this about myself until I was listening to that maybe there's some truth in that. It's kind of like after reading The Lucid View, like I said, I had a certain interpretation of what that book was about, an interpretation of this character called Aeolus Cephas. And I guess in engaging with you on your forum, it's kind of like, how come you're not that person? You know, that's kind of the thought about it. And I think I got that kind of out of that conversation you were having. Is maybe I was kind of doing that. How come you're not this person that I thought you were? So it's kind of like, and I think you were saying something about trying to correct that in that person. Like the fan comes to that who they admire and say, hey, you know, you need to be more like this because this is how I thought you were. So I don't know that I was necessarily doing that, but I can kind of see that in maybe how I was engaging you on the forums. I was trying to correct Cephas, and you're not being true to Aeolus Cephas or that character that I thought you were back then. But,
so you're referring back to the previous forum at this point then?
No, on the recent. KubraCon,
more recently, even though
I wouldn't have thought of it then, and I wasn't even thinking in terms of, oh, this is Aeolus Cephas, because I knew you'd kind of given that whole thing up. It's kind of like, how come you're not this more agnostic kind of person that I thought that person was? You know, you just said that you're more dogmatic, and I had the impression from Lucid View that this is someone like myself that doesn't believe anything, you know, maybe just plays with ideas and just to see what they do or how they can color your perception and then give them up when they're no longer necessary. That was the impression that I got back then, because that's what I had been doing for years. So... Yeah, I've always been kind of anti-dogmatic.
Me too. And I use that term consciously just to simplify, like, that is how it could be. That's how it could. There's always that risk. But of course, and if I say, well, I don't see it as dogmatic, I see it as grounded, well, I mean, people who are dogmatic generally don't see themselves as dogmatic, they just see themselves as right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and liminalism, ironically or fittingly, liminalism is about leaving things in question, leaving things open. It's the inverse of dogma, because it's anti-structure.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, I mean, dogma is structure. But I think I know there's a difference between what I've called liminalism now, in terms of this being in the ambivalence and being in the unknowing, insofar as not staying too far from what we know. So I mean, the difference between that, I mean, that might have sounded like a paradox, but I mean, if there's very little that we know for sure, in order to move away, I'm not sure how to put this into words, actually. It's an interesting paradox, because I don't think the experience of not knowing in itself is has value. I think the value of it is that unless we're willing to admit that we don't know, we will kid ourselves, we will deceive ourselves that we do know, in order just to move. So liminalism is about moving forward without knowing, but it's not about just floating in some limbo where we can't ever know anything. And that's closer to what I think lucid view, what I was like back then, Jake and Aeolus. In the terms I use now, I was entirely disembodied and didn't know it. I didn't even realize that that I was, well, I knew I was creating a myth for myself consciously, but somehow I felt that would work, like the as if philosophy of occultism, like act as if it's true and it will, and if you get the results then it's as good as true. That was kind of my path then. So I was creating these identities, and the movie guy, and Aeolus gave us the cosmic guy, and I kind of had my destiny mapped out. And as you know, I now see that a lot of that, or most of that, was sourced in intense anxiety from trauma about being powerless, and just an unwillingness to feel as powerless as I was feeling, and so this need to create these beliefs. And so somehow I think that the lucid view thing of saying, well, we don't know what's true anyway, so don't believe anything, I think there's a kind of trick in that, or a double thing, where you can get to, you feel that you can get to say what's true. And so I'd say that's what you're getting at, about playing with ideas, and I was doing it back then, and I'm not interested in playing with ideas now. I mean, I'm not saying I don't do it still, but at least at a conscious level, I consider ideas to be, to just be that, to be toys, really, as opposed to, well, I don't know what the, I don't know what to call the other thing for risk of dogma, right? But a felt sense or a knowing about something that is experiential and that one can build on, but it's destructive rather than creative. So the playing with ideas, you're building these castles, you're building this second matrix, whereas the thing I've been doing now, I never know what to call it, work or play, hopefully both, has been about getting to the ground. So it's about been breaking down these ideas, that some of which I've created, but even there, mostly building on ideas that were implanted in me previously, kind of through this back door, or this cunning of, you don't have to believe it, but just try it on for size. I think there's something about that tricks us. We think we can just try beliefs on, but if we're traumatized, I don't think we can. We're unconsciously creating these crucial fictions, and so if an idea fits, we don't think of it just as a belief anymore. We think, oh, I found the truth.
Mm-hmm. That's the trap.
Yeah.
See, for me, belief, though, it goes back to that root, the German word, Liebe, which is love, roughly translated. So when someone believes something, they're really loving the idea. They're embracing the idea more than they are the actual experience. I mean, like you said, embodied. To me, to know something is to feel it fully. And believing is more jumping on the interpretation and falling in love with it in some way. And that's why I can't embrace that. I'm like you, it's more, how does the body feel? How do I feel in my body? I mean, I totally am on board with what you're talking about when it comes to that, being embodied, being in the world and experiencing it directly without the color of all these beliefs. I don't even like the word beliefs. To me, they're more ideas, and the belief aspect is falling in love with the idea, the model of how we interpret it.
Mm. Yeah, I've made that parallel myself for myself, that belief is like taking something to heart.
Mm-hmm. And obsessing over it to a certain extent.
Investing in it would be another way of putting it. Like, mm-hmm. This is meaningful to me. So I think you can do that without believing it. As in, you can say, well, I don't believe in alien underground bases, but it's meaningful to me. And then, but is it? I mean, there's a kind of blurry area there where the mind is so cunning and clever, the guardian, let's say, the constructed identity mind, that it will say, well, this is just a metaphor and I'm going to use it, but some at a deeper level, we're taking it to heart. And I think that, I mean, the Streber thing is a way for me to map that process, I guess, for me, because I took Streber to heart, and I ended up having dreams that I believe were real as a result of it, including underground alien bases. So at that point, what? I may be writing that, well, this is imaginal, and this is, you know, the sort of higher end of the lucid view, and the Aeolus Caifas output was all about how we are kind of projecting our unconscious onto the tapestry of the world, or whatever, however I put it back then. But I'm not sure that's so different from Streber saying, well, I never said they were extraterrestrials, and then writing a whole chapter about you know, the extraterrestrial model kind of thing. It's a sort of double thing. We'll be right back.
speaking of Streber, you know, I saw your review of Supernatural. And at first, I was, at the time when you posted that one, I was actually reading the book. I was actually kind of looking forward to, okay, where are they going with this now? After I'd been reading all the things that you were writing, Kripal and Streber and everything, where are they going together on this? So I was in the reading it, and I saw your review, and I thought, okay, I'm not going to let that color my perception of it. They're not, but I couldn't even finish the book. I got to the last chapter, and I was like, I'm done with this now. So I think I kind of agree with your review of the book. I thought there were some interesting points made in it, but overall, there was nothing new in that book to me. I mean, I didn't see the point of it.
Right.
Maybe it's for the mass audience to jump on board what they're trying to get across. I don't know, but for someone like me, I've been there, done that, and I know I've kind of said that on your forums a few times of certain ideas and things, but I kind of felt like, you know, this is just worthless, you know? That's just kind
of
how
And so you didn't read my review. You did get to the end of the book before you read my review?
No, I think I was maybe on the second or third chapter at the time. It took me a little while to read it. I thought I'd go right through that book, but it wasn't as engaging to me. But I read your review probably when I was right at the beginning of the book.
Okay.
By the time I pushed myself through that book and I got to that last chapter and it was done for me, I can't even be bothered with it anymore.
Mm.
So whether your criticisms of what they're doing, if they have any merit, I don't know. Maybe they are advocating trauma. I don't know if that's how I would put it necessarily.
Well, it did seem, I mean, it seemed as though it was about the only thing in that book that was it all new or was it all challenging, and maybe that's me. I mean, obviously I'm going to zero in on that because I'm looking for it, and so this is a valid question of you. How clearly can I look at the evidence when I've already kind of reached my own conclusions? But anyway, that was my estimation, was that almost all of the book was kind of just a rehashing of previous attempts to introduce the supernatural, the paranormal, or the whatever non-materialistic interpretation of reality to a mass audience. So then, what stood out as new to that model was the trauma, the traumatic secret, which is Kripal's interest, and it's Kripal who is promoting Streber. So. Yeah, it's not a smoking gun, but...
Yeah, the traumatic secret, though... See, for me, that's not even a new idea. That's been around for a while. Maybe it wasn't called that. Maybe they didn't frame it in terms of trauma.
Mm.
But there's nothing new in it for me. I mean, obviously, right. that's the way of the shaman, is like a deliberate trauma, or maybe it's an accidental trauma. Something triggers these experiences, and you have to come to terms with it in some way. And you supposedly, in theory, you come out the other side and you go back and you help the tribe. And for me, that's nothing new. I mean, it's...
Well, sure, it's nothing. I mean, but that's...
There's events throughout your life. You can call them traumas, you can call them whatever, but there's always before that event and after that event. And going back to childhood, those types of traumas that you're talking about, I totally understand why you're investigating that and trying to uncover what's going on as children that we don't remember, and maybe something, why we don't remember certain things, you know. I feel like I have a memory that goes back pretty far. As far as linear memory, that didn't start till maybe 4 or 5 years old, but I remember a lot before that time. I just couldn't tell you exactly what age I was when it happened. But So a lot of the childhood trauma that you're talking about, I personally don't feel I can relate to. Maybe the trauma of being born might be, you know, I don't remember that necessarily. I know I was listening to your, I can't remember his name, I think his last name was Golding, it was one of the more recent.
Mark, yeah.
And the whole thing about circumcision. I've been circumcised, like I'm assuming a lot of people in the United States have been. I don't remember that, and I don't feel that there's anything kind of like what he was saying, he doesn't feel like it was anything to him that's affected him in any way. But
well, that's not what he said.
I don't really remember how he put it necessarily.
I mean, he juxtaposed the memory of his mother, and somehow he did remember that, even though he was only 8 days old.
That's right.
He felt like he had a memory of his mother's distress, and so he juxtaposed that with the fact that he had no physical memories of the pain of the circumcision itself. But he did say that, but he didn't extrapolate from that he didn't think it would have done any harm. I mean, you see, for me, it's a mystery to me, Dylan, how you or anyone could even imagine that wouldn't be profoundly traumatic. It's a mystery.
Well, from my perspective, though, is how would I know any different? You know what I mean?
Well, but you could torture a kitten and say, well, that kitten was just born, so how would it know any different? It doesn't mean that the kitten isn't experiencing all kinds of chemicals.
Well,
all kinds,
I mean, I don't agree
reactions.
With that necessarily either. I mean, I think it is traumatic, but from my own experience, I don't have any memory of it, and I've never tried to uncover any memories of it. I don't remember, like you said, I don't remember the pain. I don't remember if my mother was there. I don't even know how it happened. I didn't even realize I was circumcised till years later. I mean, it's just just looking into those things. I mean, I wouldn't have known any difference. So it's...
Yeah. So then the mystery to me now is that you've read so much of my writing, Prisoner of Infinity and the rest of it, and yet you don't seem to have retained any memory of those descriptions in terms of how trauma affects us at a bodily level and has nothing to do with what we remember later on.
I actually do agree with that. I mean, it maybe it has affected me. I don't know how it would affect me, though, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's... My life has been what it is ever since I was born, so I mean, I wouldn't know any different because I didn't live a different life without that. See what I mean? I think that's
what... Well, I do see what you mean, but that's a very scientific approach. It's like, let's take two kids, traumatize one and not the other, and make everything else exactly the same, and then we can tell. But that is very exclusive to a scientific kind of model, and it's very sort of objective. And in terms of... I mean, what I write about in Prisoner Infinity and other places isn't to do with that. Isn't to do with what would you be like if you hadn't been traumatized. It's just to do with what can we explore and examine and to some degree understand about the effects of trauma and how identity forms in the presence of or as a side effect of such trauma. How the formation of identity is altered by trauma. And for example, I mean, to give the simpler or the widest sort of description, how a self-care system is installed in the psyche, how the identity becomes a kind of self-care system that functions partially by self-traumatizing. So constant self-traumatizing in order to dissociate. That whole mechanism, which I had a hard time trying to describe to Mark, and I'll have a hard time trying to describe it to you. It's why I wrote the damn book to begin with. And it's very interesting that people have read it, and including people like yourself who really felt they got something from it. But the idea, here's that word again, the I'll say the reality of trauma and how it impacts the formation of identity, we can't somehow take it on because it's like the trauma itself, it's too big for the identity that's created by trauma to encapsulate. It's a bit like trying to explain to Neo, which is an old model, the Matrix while he's still in it. Like he has to actually be taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's too easy a model, but just because it's easy, I use it. Like, how do we understand? It is similar to what you're saying. How do you know what you would be like if you weren't traumatized? And I'm carrying, well, how can we, not rhetorically, but really as a question, how can we begin to explore the shape of our shape of the self, of the total self, of the psyche, while confined to the fragment that is the constructed identity brought about through trauma. I mean, it's a conundrum. I don't think of a better model as one of those weird models, or not like a Chinese finger trap, but something like that, where, and I suppose that this is at the root of many things that you've explored around occultism and the rest of it, which is to do with how to escape belief and how to escape thought, or, you know, the patterns of thought and the patterns of thinking. All of those practices seem to come down to a similar goal, but I would say that they seem to leave out the most fundamental questions, which is, well, how was the trap built to begin with? How and why? And so, like, if you felt throughout your life, as somebody who's pursued freedom or knowledge or whatever else you would call it, through your different paths, you must have felt somehow imprisoned by your own identity. So then I would say, I mean, I didn't give a chance to answer that, I'll give you a chance in a second, maybe you disagree, but if that were the case, you could say, well, that's how circumcision affected you. I mean, that's how you experience it. It's not as a memory. It's a feeling of being cut off from whatever it is that you feel that you've been trying to work your way back to.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, that could be totally correct. I mean, but I really don't know where to go with that one, really, to be honest with you. Reflecting lately about these things, you know, going back to childhood, and I think about that that dream that I sent you a while back. I think it was while I was reading Prisoner of Infinity at the time. I don't know if you remember it or not, but I was dreaming that I was sitting looking at a computer screen, and I opened up a video. I don't know if I can remember all of it right now. I have it written down, but the video revealed that my entire life since a certain age has been totally false, and there was some girl involved and we were being experimented on, and all of my memories from that age up till now, or I forget what it was, but not a certain time period in my life, I think it was just totally false. So everything I remember about it never happened that way. And that really, I woke up from that dream that day, and I had a long, heated discussion with my wife about it. She thought I just kind of lost it a little bit. It really affected me, because it really made me think about, did anything even happen? You know, I mean, the way I remember things, did any of it happen? You know, it's just, I memory has always been a thing for me, thinking about it, and I've obsessed over memory, and I have a hard time remembering things. I mean, you can probably tell that just by talking to me now. I got to think about, you know, when I'm by myself and in my own thing, memories just come to me. But when I'm trying to talk to people, I have a hard time really remembering details to bring it back up and discuss it. Even my own dreams and things like that. And there was the other dream where I think I told you these. I don't know if you remember them or not, but I think.
Yeah, I remember that one somewhat dimly. I definitely remember you sending.
Yeah, dream. Well, there was another one too. It was the first time I'd ever had a dream inside of a dream, waking up and not actually waking up out of a dream.
Mm.
I was underwater looking at sharks. The sharks were benevolent. They were perfectly fine. And then I had this feeling of drowning all of a sudden. And then I woke up in the bathtub, like I'd been falling asleep in the bathtub. It was totally real feeling. And after I was waking up in the bathtub, then I woke up in the bed. And it's like, wow, that, I really wasn't in the bathtub after all. But that part of the dream felt like I really did fall asleep in a bathtub, even though I hardly take baths. I take showers usually, but it's kind of strange that it felt so real.
Hmm.
But I wonder about those kinds of dreams. It made me think of that whole, the birth memory, you know, Stanislav Grof and his matrices and, you know, forget how he called it, oceanic bliss, and then coming into that, that's where the theory that the alien abduction scenario comes from, being born and all these things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why Prisoner of Infinity was interesting to me, because I've had those similar types of experiences. I've just never translated them as being abducted by aliens or anything, but I've had experiences that could be taken that way.
Mm-hmm.
I always sit aside trying to interpret things like that. I'll use whatever interpretation in the moment maybe can communicate it to someone else. When I'm by myself, I don't really think too much about, you know, how to interpret it.
Right.
It's mainly been When I started getting online back in 2003 and trying to communicate to other people, I think is when I really started using models and metaphors more, attempting to communicate experience, I guess. And how do you do that? You have to utilize something.
Mm.
Unless you can just take that person and put them through that experience, which, you know, even then it's not going to be the same exact experience that you have, so.
Right. Well, that last point was interesting. Speaks to what I said earlier about how people can communicate by triggering each other. Because that is what we do, I think, when we can't convey our experience. We just try and make the other person have it. We try and make them feel however we're feeling.
You know, in that, I feel like that's really unethical to do that, because I wouldn't force someone to have an alien abduction, you know. You know what I mean? But more than likely, most people, if you remodel certain experiences a certain way, they may understand what you're talking about differently. If you just model it in terms of being abducted by, you know, whatever you want to call them, aliens or whatever, they might not relate to that. But if you model it a different way, like birth memory, for example, they might be able to understand what you're talking about, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I don't ever know if I'm understood. I always feel like every time I write anything, post something online, it's like I never know if I've really come across and been clear in what I'm trying to communicate. Mm-hmm. My agnosticism probably comes off about it. My, you know, just not knowing and just using certain metaphors to try to communicate what I really don't know.
So I think a big question around that then is not so much what we're trying to communicate, but why we feel the need to communicate it. Because
mm-hmm.
It seems as though, I mean, the more, the stronger the need to communicate, needless to say, the more at stake there is, and that in itself, it seems as though that would cause us to grasp at straws in terms of not so much the person's response, or, you know, be clinging to the person's response, there would be that, but also just in terms of how we communicate. So you're talking about models and how you had to come up with metaphors and models to try and be understood. Well, presumably the more pressure there is for us to communicate and be understood, the more we would the more rashly we would adopt models and beliefs in order to try and make sense of our experience, and so that we would be understood. this isn't really leading anywhere, I'm just thinking out loud, but in terms of obviously crucial fictions and areas we've already been talking about, beliefs and all the rest of it, taking things to heart, that would be partly why. And how that goes again back to the formative experiences as children, as infants, if we're, or I should say when we're in distress pre-verbally and we can't convey the distress, so just something as simple and as perhaps inevitable, certainly in my generation, as being left in the crib for too long and unfed and unheard, that would imprint us with this ferocious anxiety around communication. Because you don't, you know, as infants, you don't have any model at all. You don't even have language. It's all bodily, so you just, you know. Well, I was going to say, you just have to scream, but...
You're 13, sometimes. I was just going to say, you would act it out, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly, the tantrum. But that, I mean, that it's already too late, in quotes, by that point, because if you think of the transition from the being in the womb, where in ideal circumstances anyway you're at harmony with the mother, because it depends on how much harmony she's in, but whatever, you're actually part of her body, so there isn't much need to communicate at that point. And well, I guess even there you could say conditions might be bad in the womb, and then you're fucked, right? There's no way. But anyway, the idea I was introducing was that the infant being in instant communication with the mother, and how we have to transition from instant communication to more mediated communication, and then the possibility of failed communication and the intense anxiety around that. And I think this does speak to this kind of indescribable process of being split, and how we get split into these different altars which are come about in order to try and get what we need to survive. So we've got a nice altar that will be nice and give whatever, you know, be well behaved to get what it wants. Then we've got the furious altar that will just demand it, and we've got the suicidal altar that will just want to contract and die, and so on. And I think that we move in and out of those altars at a conscious level all day long. I know I do, in terms of moods and inexplicable moods. But then there's the deeper question of what if we have altars that are so kind of isolated that we don't remember moving into them. What if we spend periods of our existence in an altar that is isolated from our primary identity, and so we don't even remember it? And you know, how would that awareness come to us at all? It would have to come through dreams. And seems like we've both had these dream experiences. I've had countless ones where I'm completely awake in the dream, and I know that this is a different me and it's a different existence, and waking up isn't waking up, it's moving from one altar to another.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that does potentially, anyway, that throws into question one's entire existence, really, like in a way that is it pulls the ground out, right, from everything. I mean, that really is truly liminal. I'm saying, well, this is what I believe. Well, but if you don't believe what the identity, if you can no longer believe in the identity that believes what it believes, then everything is up for grabs, it seems. So, yeah. Part 2 of this conversation with NKB is coming Wednesday. Thanks to Daniel and Aileen for donating.
inside you.